If only the walls could talk, the stories they'd tell. The jail cell, the boudoir, the library. Who was conceived in a burst of passion, or on what library desk was that first draft of the masterpiece written? Of course, the walls and the buildings do tell stories, but I think you need a very good interpreter. James Crawford is an excellent interpreter. James has collected the memories of buildings and the stories of buildings in his new book, Fallen Glory. It really is a collection of 25 biographies of significant buildings that no longer stand, except, of course, in memory and legend. In these biographies, he gives the full life cycle of the building, its birth, the purpose, the way it all ended, and, of course, what these structures say about us and how we remember them. James Crawford works with Scotland's National Collection of Architecture and Archaeology. He's written many books, but I think, dare say, this is probably his finest. Fallen Glory, The Lives and Deaths of the World's Greatest Lost Buildings. James, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
James, this book isn't actually an architectural overview of those constructions. It's a very clever, sort of deft way, I've got to say, to delve into history across the centuries. So what was your aim?
Yeah, it was very much this idea of life cycle. I mean, one of the things I kind of experienced when you read about buildings, when you read about architecture, it tends to be very fixated on the physical detail, on the technical detail, and quite often the human story gets left out. But of course, the human story is absolutely central to architecture. You know, it's people that dream up buildings, it's people who build structures, it's people who live in them, and it's very often, predominantly the case, people who destroy them. So I wanted to explore that kind of aspect of architecture. And as you say, not do an architectural history, but do a history of people through architecture. It was really trying to kind of subvert the norm, to sort of turn it around, to have this sort of different approach.
You write in the introduction that unlike the people who built these buildings, these structures experience not just one sort of major historical event, but a whole series of them. I mean, the same building can involve Julius Caesar or Napoleon or Adolf Hitler. So for every building, the purpose is to outlive and outsee their creators?
It doesn't always work like that, but often that is the case, particularly with some of the most famous buildings, the most famous ancient buildings in the world, is that they have passed through so many different lines of history, the sort of arbitrary lines of history that we draw. We know when we learn history, for example, you think about the Roman period, when you learn about that, you learn about the sort of rise and the fall, but the buildings that the Romans created have obviously continued all the way up to the present day. And they then have contemporary relevance. You know, Mussolini and Hitler have reappropriated sort of Roman architecture for the sort of ideology of the fascist regimes. And I really wanted to kind of follow those stories, to kind of take you from the construction of something like the Roman Forum all the way up to the Second World War and the rise of Nazism, the rise of fascism, because I thought that was a really interesting take and a different take that I hadn't really seen before.
When you think about the Nazi period of architecture, you've just triggered a memory for me there. I've been to that arena, as it were. There's not much of it left in Nuremberg, but you can see it. And there really was an attempt there by Hitler and Speer, I'm assuming, to sort of recreate the Roman arena.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the fascinating things about, there was a sort of fascism sort of grand tour that Mussolini invited Hitler to Rome in the late 1930s, and the kind of world was watching, the world media was kind of watching these two sort of larger-than-life dictators undergo this sort of display of fascist pageantry. And Mussolini used the buildings, the Roman buildings, the sort of ancient buildings, as part of this. He lit them up, he had processions going past them. And Hitler was sort of blown away by this experience. And when he returned to Berlin, he said to his sort of chief architect, Albert Speer, "We're not going to use modern materials anymore. We're only going to use the materials that the ancients used, like marble, stone, limestones," because he wanted the buildings that he created for his Third Reich to look as picturesque and beautiful thousands of years later when they were ruined too. He wanted to create a legacy for the German people that he felt the Italian people had as a result of the Roman Empire. So you can sort of see the influence, the kind of, I mean, that's not a benign influence, that's a subversion or a misrepresentation by Hitler of what these things were created for, but he saw a sort of beauty and empire from Rome that he wanted to recreate.
It also suggests, though, James, that even someone responsible for the most radical evil that we've seen, like Hitler, was smart enough to realise that his own Reich, even though he thought it would be a thousand-year Reich, wouldn't last forever, and something physical would outlast it.
Absolutely, yes. Obviously, he was conscious of his own mortality. That was one of the few things he couldn't try to control. You know, he was obviously aware that. And architecture has always been about the quest for some degree, not necessarily of immortality, but of legacy, sort of thousands of years down through the centuries. You know, that's what people are sort of looking for when they build. I mean, the very early story of architecture, which comes from clay tablets found in Mesopotamia thousands of years ago, is the Epic of Gilgamesh. And that's a story about a man who sets out to try and find the secret of immortality from the gods, and who fails, and who kind of comes back to the city that he's built downcast. And as he walks through the sort of walls of his city, he suddenly realizes that with architecture, he has his best chance at immortality. But even that will fall short.
What's the importance, James, of buildings whose authenticity is contested? I mean, buildings in mythology like the Tower of Babel. What's the importance of those? Because they're in your book too.
Yeah, I mean, the Tower of Babel is the first building that I write about. And I write about it because it's the first great myth of architecture. But there are ruins and remains which can be considered to have been the origin story for the myth. I mean, I'm not suggesting that Tower of Babel, a sort of tower reaching all the way up to the heavens actually existed. But there are a number of candidates. There was a temple tower in Babylon, which may be one of the sort of best candidates. And certainly the remains of that tower, which was 91 meters high, have been discovered in the modern remains of Babylon, and actually were co-opted during the Second Gulf War. They were right next to it. There was a helipad. So you can sort of see, I mean, that was one of the things that really did interest me, was the extent to which you have possibly one of our oldest buildings, or certainly the oldest building we ever think about, is still involved and still has a resonance right now. And the fact that the Allied forces during the Gulf War based their camp at Babylon was symbolic, you know, because Babylon was still a city that people knew about from the Bible, and it had a kind of tactical value in that war.
James, there are also debates, though, about buildings or constructions that are sort of reminiscent with very bad memories. You include the Berlin Wall in your book, and there were a lot of debates about the Berlin Wall's removal. Where do you place yourself in this debate?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, the Berlin Wall, because I was born in 1978, and the Berlin Wall to me was just a fixture. It, you know, I grew up with the sort of Cold War, and you know, particularly when you're sort of younger, when you're a child, to me it was almost presented as normal that you would have a city where one side couldn't cross to the other. And when the wall is kind of pulled down, the interesting thing about the wall is it was never really a structure that had any impact other than symbolic. The wall fell on the sort of night in November 1989, but the wall was still there, but the wall had gone, and it was basically because it was a political wall. It was a social-political boundary, and once that political reality had disappeared, had kind of vanished into the sort of that November night, did it actually need to be pulled down? I mean, one of the things that happened in the aftermath is that within a year of it actually being demolished, they surveyed East and West Berliners, and something in the region of 1 in 3 wanted it put back because they were sad to see it go. So, I mean, I think that's a very interesting one, because the danger is, if you erase that history, what happens hundreds or thousands of years later? Do you erase the story?
What about, James, buildings that have, let us say, a rather confused form of symbolism? I'm thinking, referring to your book, of the Bastille. The conservative French government thought at the time they were establishing this unshakable monument to state power right there in the heart of Paris. I think the revolutionaries, you say, had a rather different view of the Bastille.
Yeah, the Bastille was the sort of the bogey building of the revolutionaries. You know, the thing about the Bastille is it started off a sort of defensive bastion against the English during the Hundred Years' War. And over time, its use gradually sort of evolved and changed to become a political prison. So it always had this kind of air of sedition about it. And, you know, all sorts of kind of myths and legends emerged out of it. The sort of famous myth of Man in the Iron Mask was the Bastille, you know, and that was kind of held up as this, you know, absolute worst example of the abuse of power by the state, a man who was incarcerated for no reason. He was kept in this sort of metal mask. It was a kind of scare story, probably not true, but it gave this building this kind of symbolism, which meant that when the revolution started, it was the first thing to be pulled down. It needed to be pulled down to be a symbol of freedom, effectively. And that's the thing about the Bastille. It is a building which was a symbol of oppression, which now absolutely is a symbol of freedom. You know, at any time that the French want to congregate to sort of demonstrate the right of man, they go to the site of the Bastille now.
We can't have this discussion about the meaning of buildings that have been lost without referring to 9/11. There's a real irony about the destruction of the 9/11 buildings in 2001, and you go into it. What is that irony? It's a tragic one.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of situate that story as almost being a story of two architects. And you had the architect who built it, Minoru Yamasaki, who was a sort of second-generation, first-generation Japanese immigrant to America, who really kind of made good, but was always an outsider throughout his time in America. And then his kind of counterpart was Mohammed Atta, who was the terrorist who flew the plane into the North Tower. And he was an architect too. He was an architectural student at Cairo and then at Hamburg Technical University. And he wrote his thesis about how he felt westernized high-rises were destroying the fabric of Islamic cities. So you had this, you know, an educated, intelligent man who was radicalized and who saw in the Twin Towers the powerful symbolism of destruction. You know, it was very much calculated to use architecture as a way of hurting people, to target architecture because of the symbolism of it.
What do you make of the attempts to, or the suggestions to resurrect something like the Twin Towers, which have been proposals over the last 10, 15 years? Can you, in fact, recreate something with the same meaning?
I don't think you can. I mean, I think that's a very dangerous road to go down because it's almost a road of denial. I mean, it's one of the things we feel we can do with buildings. But, you know, we can do it with human lives. You lose someone you love, you have to mourn them. You have no other option. You have to mourn them and you have to tell their story and you have to celebrate them. You lose a building, I think we feel, well, we've got the materials, we've got the know-how, we can reconstruct it. But you're only ever reconstructing a sort of pastiche. And I think it's not necessarily being true to the history of the building.
I've literally only got a minute left, James. I need to ask you, though, about, well, a structure that never really existed, and it was something called the GeoCity. But it really did have the characteristics of the city. Quickly, tell us, what was the GeoCity?
Well, it was the largest city in human history, 38 million people, and it was a virtual city. You know, it was a precursor to Facebook. It was where you would have your first profile pages. So people would live within this virtual digital structure. It kind of gave them a home on the internet at the time when people were really trying to grapple with what the internet was. And it lasted for a little less than a decade. It was purchased by Yahoo, who wanted to find a way to monetize it, didn't succeed, and deleted it in one day. And in deleting it, effectively destroyed what some people have described as the cave paintings of the web, those kind of first flourishings of digital culture. And it just goes to show how fragile the digital structures that we create, how vast they can be, but also how fragile they can be, as anyone who's ever had a failed hard drive will know.
Yes, well, a few of us have had those. James Crawford, author of Fallen Glory.